You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you had a great week. And I have a great documentary for you to watch this weekend. It's called WeWork. And it is written and directed by Jed Rothstein. And it follows this real estate company run by Adam Neumann, who was ultimately forced out of the company. So WeWork is this startup that pioneered the boom of co-working, obviously pre-COVID-19. It was this phenomenon in which freelancers and entrepreneurs paid to spend the workday in a shared office space. So it began as a Brooklyn desk-running outfit metastasized into Manhattan's biggest office tenant because they reached this private market valuation of, believe it or not, $47 billion, and that's before the whole thing fell apart in a failed IPO attempt. So the company would sign these long-term leases on office space, subdivided into smaller work areas, and then rent those out to freelancers or small businesses on a short-term basis. So during the boom times, it's great. It works great. But it carries this obvious risk. What happens if there's another recession and everybody leaves? So you have a lot of things that are at play in this documentary. And it's sort of like the Inventor meets Fire Festival. You have a CEO with a God complex, overeager investors, a CEO's wife who, I'm not kidding you, name drops her cousin Gwyneth Paltrow at a moment's notice. And this company culture where one of their earliest rituals was this event called Summer Camp, which was this multi-day event where you could do water sports, rope courses, and play beer pong. It's amazing, I'm telling you. And it's on Hulu. And even my husband watched the whole thing. And, you know, he never watches anything I like. This episode features an interview with the Academy Award-winning directors Dan Lindsay and TJ Martin of HBO's unbelievable documentary on Tina Turner called Tina. It is a must watch. Now, Tina Turner is known as the queen of rock and roll, rising to prominence as the front woman of Ike and Tina Turner before launching a successful career as a solo performer. In the 1980s, she launched one of the greatest comebacks in music history. Her 1984 multi-platinum album, Private Dancer, contained her hit song, What's Love Got to Do with It?, which won the Grammy Award for the Record of the Year, and it became her first and only number one on the Billboard Hot 100. And by the way, that happened when she was 44 years old, making her the oldest female solo artist to top the Hot 100. She's the first Black artist and first female to cover Rolling Stone, and Rolling Stone ranked her among the 100 greatest artists of all time and the 100 greatest singers of all time. So this is an incredible documentary, very poignant because it retraces her childhood neglect and the experiences of domestic violence, sexual abuse, and suicide attempts that she survived throughout her 16-year marriage to the late ex-husband Ike Turner. And then it shows how she freed herself from the destructive clutches of Ike, breaking out as a solo artist and exploding to worldwide fame, fulfilling her career-long goal of filling stadiums. in mesmerizing concert doc footage. So today, Tina lives in Zurich, Switzerland with her husband. She suffered a stroke in 2013, was diagnosed with intestinal cancer in 2016, and even considered assisted suicide before her husband donated a kidney for transplant surgery in 2017. Now, if you're listening to this next to your beloved, the person that is your partner in life, and you just heard me say that Tina Turner's husband donated his own kidney for transplant, I'm with you, because that's a pretty tall hill to climb. I mean, what an incredible love story. I can't say enough about this documentary. I loved it so much. I cried so hard at the end. It's an unbelievable story. And then I spoke to Walt Gear. He's this incredibly successful advertising executive. He's hysterical. And he mentioned to me that he loves the show Formula One Drive to Survive on Netflix, which I also love. So I asked him to come on the show to convince all of you why you should not be missing the show. Formula One Drive to Survive, the drivers, managers, and team owners in Formula One live life in the fast lane, both on and off the track. And so this docuseries gives you exclusive, intimate access to the people in one of the world's greatest racing competitions. And it reveals the true story of the high-octane sport, which goes beyond the fight to be number one. If you don't know anything about Formula One, it doesn't really matter, because it gives you the personal stories behind the racers, the managers, the way the whole industry works. It's fascinating and thrilling at the same time. So here we go. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
I'm fully worshiping at the Church of Tina Turner. I'm not kidding you. I watched it with my sister and we're like crying our faces off. And I'm like, simply the best. Like, you want to kick the sky. I mean, what an amazing subject. How did this project come to be?
Well, I can jump on that. It predates us in terms of us, like, you know, this wasn't something we originated. The producers, Simon Chin and Jonathan Chin, who had actually produced our last film, they had gotten, they built a relationship with Tina and her husband, Irwin, via doing some work with the musical that was first premiered in London. And so they developed a relationship and kind of, I think, you know, sold Tina on the idea of doing a feature doc and the fact that nobody had really done, you know, told her story in that form before. And so, yeah, they made the deal and then they approached us about directing it. And I think our first question was, why us? you know, we're a little trepidatious, I guess, at first. We had some concerns about two men helming Tina's story. And right. We also just didn't know, you know, we knew the broad strokes, but we didn't know the real details of her life journey. And then we also, you know, we were concerned because there had been a movie and there was a book and there was a musical that was going to come out during the process of us making the film. And so, you know, it was like, we wanted to make sure we could say something different and new with her story.
How long did this process take from beginning to end?
2.5 years, 3 years, 2.5 years, somewhere around there.
That's amazing. And she's a real force of nature. Talk about the astounding success that she found despite the racism, sexism, ageism that she experienced.
Well, I don't, you know, how do you talk about the astounding success? I mean, when anyone references her, they think of, look, as you pointed out at the beginning of this interview, you were kicking your feet in the air.
Yeah.
Church of Tina Turner, right? It's that's the best, probably the best way to think about her astounding success is she became a symbol. She became an icon, not just because of the, you know, 60-year career she had in music, where she's at this pretty much the center of popular music. You know, the birth of television, music television, the birth of MTV. And the copious amounts of records she performed and the huge legacy she left, you know, creatively on music culture and on the industry, music industry, but also, as you point out, it's her story. And that's the thing that was really, you know, the thing we're probably most drawn to is I think the feeling she leaves with people is this, as an incredible performer and through her music is something that's really intangible, because you can't disassociate the feeling that she's giving you on stage without understanding a little bit of the story she's had. And that is someone who's endured a tremendous amount of pain, as she'll say herself, feeling like she never felt love. And she was for pretty much imprisoned by Ike Turner. And she somehow got out of that and reappropriated her identity and reappropriated her name. And, the part of the thing that we were really wanting to explore in the film is on the journey of becoming this symbol and this icon, is to remind people that at the center of that is still someone who's surviving and is making the choice to survive every day. She's still processing that trauma.
And unheard of, really, that she would be that successful at age 44. Like, that's her peak moment in an industry that sort of caters to the youth. It almost seems like she got better the older she got.
I think that, what you're kind of touching on, I think, is one of the reasons we were so drawn to making the film was, I think in our minds, originally, it was just like, oh, yeah, Tina Turner was part of Ike and Tina, and then, like, she went solo and, like, you know, and was successful. And it wasn't until we were approached to do this and just, you know, looking into the facts of her life, so to speak, that we realized that it was a 7-year journey from when she left Ike to when What's Love Got to Do with It came out and kind of broke open her solo career. And she was in her mid-40s at the time. You know, and there was not, you know, you could count on your hand, one hand for sure, maybe even less of like the number of mid 40-year-old Black women in America mm-hmm. that were on MTV and, you know, successfully on pop radio. And so her journey, even after she left Ike, is this improbable kind of it's a saga in its own right. And it was something that we were really drawn to wanting to kind of lean into and tell that story. Cause like, we certainly didn't know that there were years that Tina was in Vegas and playing like the cabaret circuit, like right. just trying to get by. That part of her journey is just remarkable.
I also can't get over the fact that she never had vocal or dance training. I mean, isn't that insane?
Yes, it's totally.
It's like, what?
Yeah, I mean, she'll, you know, even Tina will say it's a gift. You know, she was in choir in church, but I think it's something that she just really loved to do and got an opportunity to refine it. You know, as much as Tina will say this herself, you know, she. As much as she does not like to spend time thinking about the Ike years, she does admit he was probably one of her greatest teachers, mm-hmm. just in terms of getting acquainted with the world of being a live performer and a touring performer. But also Ike, they would play, you know, sometimes 4 shows a night, and they would be rehearsing on their way to the next show. So Tina, picked up an amazing work ethic and even took that to the next level. I mean, that's one of the things I always forget about, even in the context of after even making the film, the thing that's one of the most admirable things about her is her work ethic and her energy is crazy. I don't know where it comes from. And I think we forget that, you know, she had a career that spanned 60 years and the amount of work it took behind the scenes to stay relevant over the course of the 6 years where she's continuing to pack stadiums, even, you know, and at 70 years old is mind-boggling.
One of the things that I really appreciated about how careful you were to tell her story as a survivor was that you pointed out, and she pointed out, that for a survivor, it's still very, it's still close to them, the pain and the trauma. And you were very careful how to show images and to show how she's been asked questions over and over by the media and how it's still so present to her that the more she even talks about him, that he even comes back into her dreams, and it's always there. So how did you come to the decision of the sequence of shots and the clips of interviews of the past? And I know you've said that, you know, she sort of opened up to you on her own, but certainly that was something that you probably spent a lot of time together thinking about and planning, like, we have to address Ike, but we want to do it in a way that she, it's her voice and it's her story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, it was, well, that kind of revelation that now we look back and we're like, why would it be a revelation that somebody who suffered such trauma would still be dealing with it, you know, well into their, you know, and she was nearing 80 years old and like, and told us that talking about that time of her life, you know, talking about the abuse or just talking about that time of her life with like can often trigger memories for her that come up in nightmares that feel as real for her as the first time it happened. And that was, you know, that was something we couldn't shake. And you know, and it made a lot of Tina's desire to not do as much press as she did, you know, like in her later career, it made a lot of that make sense. And I think, you know, for us, in terms of that particular sequence, you know, I think we're using journalists asking her questions, but really they're stand-ins for us as a public, right?
Right. And our public. That's so true. Yeah.
With her. And, you know, I think there's a part of Tina that she became this symbol of like strength and resilience in a way that maybe we started to think of her as like almost superhuman and that,
right.
You know, so we just assumed, oh, she's over this. Like, and so, you know, and that was, yeah, it was just something that was really intriguing to us. This idea of like, in some ways, Tina's public identity became like the story of Tina Turner is its own character in our film. And we wanted to kind of tell the story of Tina Turner as we, as the public, kind of cemented this identity. But we also wanted to tell the story of like Tina, right? Just Tina Turner, the person that we met when we first went to Zurich and talked to her about how she looks back at her life. And that was a really hard thing in the edit, was to find that dance between those two storylines. And part of that dance is exactly like you're saying, how do we respect Tina the person and not, you know, re-traumatize her in the same way that that she had been through other forms of this telling of her story.
And also the layers to her story, her relationship with her mother, the people that have been part of her management, all of their stories are so interesting and just really weave a much more complicated fabric to her story. And I think that all of the interviews that you got were so great. I really enjoyed listening to Angela Bassett's perspective playing her. And to see that even after all these years that she holds her with such high regard, like it was such an important figure in her life.
Yeah, you know, because we took a kind of a particular POV with this film, that kind of became our North Star for how to also cast it, for lack of better terms.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not populated with other musicians and, you know, a ton of A-list celebrities talking about her artistry. It's populated with by either individuals who have, you know, were either witness to some of these accounts or were kind of, you know, have an intimate relationship with Tina, or people who that we've called were kind of scribes, that people who have embodied in some way, shape, or form her story. So, you know, Angela Bassett, who played Tina, Carl Arrington, who wrote the People magazine article in 81, who was the first time in public, and Kurt Loder, who wrote I, Tina.
The best.
And, yeah. How great to see him back on screen. but the, yeah, I mean, the it's again, so much of it is like to preserve the integrity of how do we explore, how do we make an authentic representation in this form that is accurate to how Tina sees her own life. And so much of that is, as she points out in the film, it's the POV is very much wrapped up in pain. And the only thing, you know, that for us, we kind of subverted a little bit is to, so it didn't feel like it was a film about trauma and pain. It was actually a film about the pursuit of love. And that's when we started realizing how much at play was, it's not just about the trauma, the ripple effect of the pain and the trauma she endured from the ACT days. It's also, if you dig a little bit deeper, the real like foundational pain of feeling abandoned by her mother. And that's, you know, and the film really kind of navigates, goes on this journey of, you know, this pursuit of love and romantic love, and in terms of what does a good, healthy relationship look like, pursuit of a familial love, and ultimately at its true foundation is a pursuit of love for your own narrative, some sort of self-love and acceptance of that's actually the life you live.
It's heartbreaking by the end of it, because it really is her goodbye to everyone. And I wanted you to just kind of give us an update on, clearly this love story with her husband is immeasurably sweet. It's just so, so great. And they have this really nice life in Zurich. And we know that she's had some health issues. How is she doing today? And the story about the transplant is just bonkers too. If you could just tell everybody that.
Yeah, I mean, I can start out. I mean, in terms of the last part of your question, you know, in 2016, Tina found out that both of her kidneys had failed, and as she revealed in her book, she actually considered assisted suicide, and she was like, "I've lived a great life," but her husband, Erwin, said, I can't lose you. I don't want to lose you. And so he went and got tested, and it turned out he was a match for her. And so he ended up donating one of his kidneys to Tina. I mean, he quite literally gave a piece of himself to her. And that was such a remarkable story. And we did try to find ways to include it in the film, but it ultimately didn't really fit in the narrative that we were telling. And, you know, as we've said in the past, like you could do a 10-part series on Tina, like
right.
every chapter of her life is its own movie, including just the last like 10 years of her life. But in terms of her health now, I mean, you know, she's doing well. She's, you know, part of like, as you see in the film, she's not really interested in doing press. So she doesn't really want to do press for this film. But she's good and she's content. And I mean, you know, she's 80 years old, so she's got the same issues that she deals with that, you know, anybody does at that age. But from our understanding and from our conversations with her, she's doing well.
I can't tell you enough how much I enjoyed it. This is going to be on my list of like the best things to watch. The something you want to watch when you need an uplifting, like little spring in your step. It's masterfully done. And you should be so proud of yourselves, because it's really just a spectacular film.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm blushing. Your fan base can't see it. I'm blushing right now. Thank you.
It's really great. Well, listen, tell everybody a little bit about how they could follow you, or maybe something, the next project that you're working on.
Dan, what are we working on next?
We don't know. I mean, the biggest thing actually that we're a part of that's going to come out next is we're doing a series on 9/11.
Good.
Nat Geo. And it's a six episode series. And you know, we're executive producers on that. And it's a really remarkable, I mean, it's still coming together, but it's a really remarkable piece. And then in terms of our next directorial thing, that's still kind of up in the air. And we tend to take our time. So who knows, that could be a year from now, it could be 3 years from now. We really throw a lot of ourselves into our projects. So we usually like to take a little bit of time to kind of recuperate. And then in terms of following us, I mean, you can follow me on Twitter, but I don't really say much. That's about my only social media presence.
I don't really engage too much on Twitter, but I think the gram is probably where I spend more time on social media. I don't even know what my handle is. Oh, TJ McKay Martin, I think.
Oh boy. Walt Gear is my new obsession. He's an executive creative director of experience design for VMLY&R. He's known for amplifying stories of Black health and raising awareness for health disparities. Adweek named him one of the 50 most important people in marketing, media, and tech. He is hilarious. Welcome to the show.
I have to go find Walter Gear now. Where can I find him?
I know.
How are you, Kang?
I'm great. And I was so excited because you had mentioned that you love the show Formula One Drive to Survive on Netflix, which I also really love. Now, this show is about living life in the fast lane, both on and off the track. It's a docuseries that gives viewers exclusive, intimate access to the people in the world's greatest racing competitions. It reveals the true story of the high-octane sport, which goes beyond the fight to be number one. And there's also a battle for the heart, soul, and direction of what is surprisingly a multi-billion dollar business. So storylines include changes that a team undergoes after an ownership change and the pressures felt to outperform other drivers. I didn't know anything about Formula One racing until I started watching the show. How did you find the show?
I had no idea. So it's funny. So I'm big into motorcycle racing. So I race motorcycles, right? That's my hobby, right? As we get older, clearly I can't run as fast, right? So why not get on something that can make me move a little faster? But it was literally like one night, it might've been like a Tuesday, Wednesday night. You know how we're all like hoarding, like, you know, like, and consuming all this content now that we're all home. I saw this Formula One thing. I was like, well, that looks interesting. I'm totally not into race cars, yeah, right? Because I just looked at it as like this thing that I just wouldn't be into. And watched the first episode and I was hooked. Like, it's so interesting. And I feel like, you know, it's definitely through the three series, it's definitely grown into like a thing, right? It's like soap opera now, right? Like all the drama. And like the first one is about like the visuals and the high impact collisions and the car crashes and you're learning about people. And this last episode now is just all about like the drama and the politics of it all. And it's fucking mind blowing.
It is mind blowing. And did you have any idea of the number of people that work on just one team?
Absolutely not.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I knew it was a full team, but like, you know, again, like I've been big on like MotoGP. So watching that it's somewhat similar, right? It's somewhat similar into like pitting and everything. Like I understand the whole like technicality of what it takes to race and what everything means, the red flags, the yellow flags, the meatball flags. Like I race, right? Motorcycles. So I get that. But this whole world is just, it's different.
What did you think about the fact that this series goes into the personal narratives as well? So we're learning more about not just the race car drivers, but the team owners. How important to that, to the show, do you think the personal narrative is? Does it suck you in and make you more or less interested in the actual racing?
You know what it is? I find that this season, this third season, is the piece that really drew me in like a great deal, because now you're actually understanding the business side, right? Like they had one of the teams, and I apologize, I forgot. I know the teams by like the colors, right? The black and yellow car, right? It's like, and those guys are like those, they're like the underdogs, right? And it's like, like every conversation this guy had was about, we need to make more money. We need to get money so we can actually keep the car going. Now we got, you know, they're meeting with VCs and investors, and these investors are saying, great, we'll give you the money. We'll give you $9 million, but like your race car driver has to be from Germany. Like you're getting right. sides of the story that you've never seen before. So that part, just the business side is interesting, but it's like what you're learning and seeing like, is it's all cutthroat, like from where the money comes down through the owners down all the way down to the drivers. And it's like, you are like every piece in this entire puzzle is like a pawn, like you're a pawn on a chessboard. Like you can be replaced in a heartbeat. And that's what we're seeing in this season. Like drivers being replaced like every other minute, like this guy being promoted to this guy's job and this guy leaving and go to this place because this guy got pulled. It's like, there's like this domino effect of drivers when they move around.
Were you surprised at the athleticism, how much they're actually working out despite driving a car, and what they need to do to have the most incredible hand-eye coordination?
That part I was not, only because racing motorcycles myself, like it's fucking, it's exhausting. Like people think that you just get in one of these things, you get in a vehicle, you just go. Like I can tell you, like even for myself, when I race, like every time, like my friends and family all know when I had a race weekend, because on Monday morning when I show up in the office, my eyes are like bloodshot red, like all my my blood vessels in my eyes burst a lot, and they're bursting because the amount of like you know, I'm the strain and the focus. And you have to realize, like when we're out there, even like racing motorcycles, like I'm leaning a motorcycle over, my like my knee is on the ground, my elbow is bumping the motorcycle next to me at 140 miles an hour, 130 miles an hour, tipping, going through a turn, right? So in holding it, it takes a ton of just like energy to keep this going. And it's no different when you're in a car, right? It's like that attention, that focus, and that, like it's a lot. It's a lot.
You have some sort of adjacent expertise. Do you think you would be a great racer?
Absolutely fucking not. Can I tell you? Can I tell you? Here's the thing that everyone thinks I'm crazy, because I have friends who race cars as well. And I think racing a car is crazy, yeah. right? They think racing a motorcycle is crazy. I think racing a motorcycle is easier. Well, not easier, but I'd say it's less stressful for me, because when I crash, and I've crashed multiple times, like I crash, I throw the bike and we have leathers on and I'm sliding across the pavement and then onto the grass, wow. right? I have this fear of like, you, when you topple over in a vehicle, like we're in this is a team effort, right? Boom, 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 boom. Like I'm scared of like being caught in something, right? And you saw the one, I don't want to kind of give up if anyone hasn't seen it, but like you saw the one explosion,
yeah,
right? On one of the last episodes, like that's scary stuff, right? So absolutely not. And plus the way motorcycles turn in and hit the apex and like your braking points, everything is so different from a motorcycle to a vehicle.
So for anybody who's listening and they're like still on the fence, Formula One Drive to Survive, is this the show for me or not? What's the one thing that you want people to know about why this is something that you will watch at the end of a long day? Because I heard you were like, I got to go, I got to relax, and this is my way to relax.
You know, for one, I will say that it is a show that draws you in because of the action, right? Like it's why I was telling a friend of mine the other day, like it's why, like watching like a car chasing, you know, scene for like hours, right? Yeah. Because, and then the quality of what they're shooting and the slow motion and all that, like it's phenomenal. It's surreal. They did a beautiful job of the cinematography, but then the layer on top of that, it's like a soap opera, and the drama that occurs and the people getting fired and people getting replaced is just, it's baffling. It's mind blowing. But also to see even people like Lewis Hamilton, who's like so consistent with winning, mm-hmm. and how these teams trying to undermine him and other teams with penalties and all the, like, it's crazy. I mean, it is like watching a real life chess game kind of play out. And that's the piece that people don't see when you're just, hey, there's a race car, right. you know, thing happening on TV right now. There's a lot to it.
And the billionaire father with the prick of a son who thinks he's like so fantastic. That's a whole other episode you can like dissect.
Of course.
I love hearing your insight. I've had such a great time chatting with you on Clubhouse.
Indeed.
Tell everybody where they can find you.
You can find me on most platforms by looking up my third gears at 3RDGEERS. Third gears, simple as that.
Thank you a million times.
No, well, thank you, Kate. I appreciate this opportunity. It's been fun. The Amazing.
want to thank my great guests and remind you to click subscribe and leave a 5-star review. Join the Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey, to talk about this episode and upcoming episodes. You can follow me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. You can find me on Instagram at Kate Casey CA. Every week, I put out a must-watch list. This week, I have 8 things on that list. You can go to katecasey.substack.com to get that list every week in your inbox. Otherwise, you can find it on my socials. You can go to Patreon, patreon.com/KateCasey, to get bonus episodes. So last week, I did a fantastic bonus episode, almost 2 hours, with Taria about Jen Shah and racism and a bunch of other things. It's really good. And then you can also find me on Clubhouse. I'm on all the time under at Kate Casey, and I've got a room in Clubhouse called What to Watch with Kate. And every Monday, I go through what to watch this week, and I'm also an admin for Club Bravo. So check me on a Clubhouse, and make sure you check back next week. I will have Margaret Josephs from Real Housewives of New Jersey and some incredible other upcoming guests.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.